You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In Dan Ariely's book, Predictably Irrational, he dispelled the myth of our rationality. And if our egos haven't taken enough of a beating from him, his new book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, reveals that we are all cheaters as well. Yes, although most of us think of ourselves as honest, upright, and dependable citizens, Professor Ariely's research says otherwise. Sit back, relax, listen, and try not to sweat. That's a sure giveaway. The book is published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased, at least I think I am, that it brings Dan Ariely, the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Economics at Duke University, back to our show today. Hello.
Hey, great to see you again.
Now, most of us do see ourselves as basically honest and trustworthy. Are we just lying to ourselves?
Sadly, yes. And if you think about it, I'm not going to embarrass you here, but think about how often do we really lie. And you would recognize that we do it quite often, many times for social politeness. It's not always, stealing pencils from the office. But we do all kinds of things that are slightly dishonest. And what's really interesting is how quickly we're able to not think of ourselves as dishonest people, and we keep this image of ourselves as wonderful individuals.
An example is taking pencils or pens from the office?
Another example, of course, is being polite to people. You know, the standard question, honey, how do I look in this dress? But more importantly, there are things like what happens when we deal with companies, what happened when we are accountants, what happened when we are physicians, what happened when we have professional roles and our obligations are kind of split. And what we find in those situations is that people have a tendency to basically lie a little bit.
Well, Freud seemed to think that self-deception took a terrible toll on a person. Do you see it as pervasive? What cost do we pay for lying to ourselves?
So I think it is very pervasive. It happens all the time. And the cost is short-term versus long-term, and the cost is for society. So we might take some shortcuts right now, and we might pay for it. And, of course, there is society. So let's just think about how this might work out. So let me describe a little simple experiment we do. We show on the screen some dots to people, and we say, the more dots on the right, the more dots on the left. And by the way, you get paid 10 times more if you say right than left. And one way to think about it is that imagine you're a physician, and there's a question, is treatment A or treatment B better for the patient? But by the way, you as the physician get more money if you say treatment A. And what we
But are you assured that treatment A will be just as efficacious as treatment B?
No, in many cases it's not. Right? So sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. The same. So this is basically conflicts of interest. Sometimes you see more dots on the right, and you can say right is the right answer. And sometimes there's more dots on the left. And if you say left, you get much less money. And if you say right, you all of a sudden get more money. So this is a conflict of interest situation. And we all are placed with this all the time. And the question is, what happens when we do these experiments? And what we see happening is that people for quite a while, we give people hundreds of those decisions. For quite a while, they cheat a little bit, like exaggerate just a little bit here, a little bit there. But at some point, many people switch and start cheating all the time. And we call this the what the hell effect, right? And you can think to yourself that if you try to think of yourself as an honest person, but you can't think of yourself, you might as well go all the way.
And none of them just are totally honest from start to finish?
So we do see in every experiment we do, we have some people who are perfectly honest. What we don't know if it's the same people over and over. So there's a question of whether honesty is a personality trait that some people are honest all the time. But I'll give you an example. In all of our experiments, everything I describe in the book, we've tested about 30,000 people. And we had about 12 big cheaters in this list, and those people have stolen from us maybe $150. And we had 18,000 little cheaters, and they stole from us about $36,000. And I think it's actually reflective of what's happening in society. There are big cheaters from time again, and they steal some money, and it's really sad, but the real majority of economic loss in society is all the little cheaters, all of us who can think of ourselves as good people, cheat a little bit, and then do it again and again and again.
So when we look at what happened with John Edwards and compare that to what happened with Bernie Madoff, there are differences, aren't there?
So, it's hard to tell. I haven't been able to talk to either of them. I do lab experiments on these results, and then I've been talking to big cheaters.
Well, I mean, Bernie Madoff was a con man, and John Edwards was covering up an affair that he had.
That's right.
While his wife was sick, and I guess he justified it that, well, he was feeling a bit lonely, and he needed female companionship.
That's right. So we can speculate, but I'll give you my speculation, right? And it's pure speculation. I can't say anything for sure. So in Madoff's case, what surprises me about this whole thing is that if the guy was a crook, if he planned the whole thing up front, how come he didn't have an exit strategy? Right? If somebody really thought carefully about what they're going to do and planned the $40 billion scheme, wouldn't he plan even the small probability? Wouldn't he buy some island somewhere that he can escape to? The fact he didn't do that suggests to me that he probably didn't think very carefully about what he was doing. Now, I've talked to many big cheaters, and the story I get from all of them is the same. They took one step in the wrong direction, thinking it's going to be one step, thinking that next time things will be different, not thinking about being caught, not thinking about the next step. And with Edwards'
they often say, I was planning to pay it back, and then I got on the slippery slope.
That's right. And that actually is a very different mindset, because when we create regulations to try and think about how to decrease punishment, we have a model of people as if they think about being caught. We create huge punishment for being caught because we said, oh, people would think about this up front. And we say, oh, I don't want to be caught. Therefore, don't let me start with this misbehavior. But I think when people take the first step, they almost never think about the probability of being caught, the size of the punishment, and so on. In Edward's case, again, I saw him in a restaurant not too long ago, and I kind of wanted to talk to him, but kind of, you know, it's difficult to go and strike a conversation about this with somebody. Also, I met Clinton a few weeks ago, and I had the same thought. I didn't dare to do it. You wonder what happens to people's sense of what is right and what is wrong when they're in politics. People get this incredible sense of power. And all of a sudden, it's not clear, I think, to them what are the right rules and wrong rules. And my kind of casual observation on politics is really quite dirty. All kinds of things are happening that we as citizens don't really know. And all of a sudden, the boundaries between legal and illegal become probably a bit more murky.
Well, don't, in those cases, and often we see it with athletes as well, people facilitate for you. So they make it a lot easier because they're saying to you, it's okay. First we carry your bags and then we do this and then we do that. Or in the case of politicians, you know, we'll cover it up for you.
That's right. And everybody else is doing it. You know, one of the things we find out in the results is that when we do an experiment and we show the subject, the participant, somebody else cheating in an egregious way, all of a sudden people are starting to see this as accepted. You go to most young people these days and you ask them, how many of you would be embarrassed if the New York Times published your name tomorrow and said that they found that you have illegal music on your computer? Nobody I've met have said they would be embarrassed. Right? There's basically a sense, everybody knows it's illegal, but everybody says there's no embarrassment in this. This is something everybody's doing. It's a standard. It's basically like corruption. Everybody's doing it, therefore we don't have to feel bad about it. And I think for politicians, there's all kinds of behavior that have become this way. By the way, for bankers too, different behaviors, but have also become just acceptable.
Well, also for law officers, the other day we were talking about the Knapp Commission, which looked into corruption in New York City's police department a while ago, if you remember that story. If you entered a certain precinct houses, everybody was on the take. That was just the culture of the precinct house. You might have said, I won't take for myself, but you would never squeal on all the other cops. You understood that was part of the system.
Yeah. Can I say something not so nice about NPR? Is it okay?
Sure.
So while ago,
we are just an NPR station. We are not NPR.
Okay, that's good.
But don't say anything bad about WNYC.
Oh, no, of course, okay. Would never. So I talked a long time ago to a fundraiser that at the time was working for NPR, and they told me about the things that they were considering and willing to do, and it was shocking to me about kind of the boundaries of morality and how they were willing to do it.
An example.
I don't want to give an example. But it struck me that I think that person was willing to do all kinds of slightly shady things in terms of what they tell people other people are giving and how they phrase giving and so on, because they were feeling they were working for a good for a good cause. And actually, we started an experiment after that, inspired by this idea. And what we find is that when people work for a good cause, or when they work for the benefit of their friends, all of a sudden their moral shackles loosen up. And we see these corporations, right? I talked to somebody who was involved in the MCI accounting scandal. And basically, when he was fixing the numbers for MCI in their accounting system and, you know, changing things, he was not doing it for his benefit at all. I mean, you know, as a shareholder, maybe tiny bit. It was mostly for the benefit of the company, of other people who were dependent on him. And when we do experiments and we say, Lenny, when you're going to cheat, your friends are going to benefit from that as well. The more friends are going to benefit, the more you're going to do it, and the more you like your friends, the more you're likely to do it.
My guest is Dan Ariely. His latest book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. The book is published by HarperCollins. Within the field of rational economics, what's thought to be the cause of cheating?
So that's a very simple story, right? In rational economics, it's all about external rewards. You pass by a gas station and you ask yourself, how much money is in the till? What's the chance it'll catch me? How much time would I get in prison? Is it worth it? Right? So it's all about the external consequences of what we do.
Does anybody ever think that way? You mentioned earlier that often people just don't think about the end result. If you're smoking marijuana, you're not thinking, I'm doing this because and I'm going to go to jail for it. Or killers never seem to think about whether they're going to get the death penalty or not when they're killing.
That's right. I think that, you know, there might be some psychopaths who think this way, but I think it's a very bad description of human motivation. Now, the sad thing is that we believe that this is the cause, and because of that, we create a legal system and a punishment system that is trying to deter people based on wrong principle. The other thing with the death penalty you mentioned, there was a study recently by the National Academy of Sciences that looked at all the results about what is the effect of the death penalty on the propensity for murder, for example, and they find no evidence. Now, the studies are not that great, but it's really hard to find any evidence that even a big punishment, right, it's hard to get a bigger punishment than the death penalty, is going to influence people's decisions. So we have this wrong model. We all have the intuition about what's causing bad behavior. The intuition is wrong. Now we go ahead and we create this legal system and punishment system that assumes a certain mindset of criminals. And I think, you know, sure, there is some blue-collar crime, but the real problem of conflicts of interest, of things in medicine, in Wall Street, in accounting, and so on, we're basically not thinking about them carefully. And because of that, we're getting people to behave very badly with unbelievable financial devastation.
But for most of us, it's going to be something a lot more petty, like somebody giving us more change than they should have, or finding a wallet and having to decide whether to leave all the cash in it, or say, I found it with the cash missing.
Yeah, so most of the time it's going to be small things like that. But there are positions of power. Imagine you're an accountant. All of a sudden, life changes quite a bit, or you're a physician, or you're a banker. So the dishonesty that we find actually depends on the opportunities you're getting. And many of us deal with lots of situations that have very broad gray zones in which we have flexibility, including flexibility to misbehave.
What did a story on This American Life, getting back to public radio, about the volunteers who work for the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts tell us about honesty?
Yeah, so this was a fantastic story about they were selling stuff in a gift shop, and lots of money was missing every time. About $150,000 a year were gone missing, and they thought there was some crook out there. And indeed, they found somebody that was stealing money, but that person was stealing a very small amount of money. And what they discovered was that lots of people, lots of very nice, kind people who were mostly volunteering, were just kind of helping out themselves from time to time. And my guess is that they were probably justifying it to themselves. They said, well, I came here as a volunteer. They surely want to buy me a cup of coffee. Here is my cup of coffee, and so on. The other interesting thing is not only was it very pervasive by kind people who are volunteer, but the moment they create a system that made it much more explicit about what you're getting and what you're not getting, the cheating went away. There's a little joke, and the joke is that Johnny comes home from school with a note from the teacher that says that little Johnny stole a pencil from the kid who's sitting next to him. And Johnny's father is furious. And he said, Johnny, I'm embarrassed and humiliated. You never, never, never steal a pencil from the kid who's sitting next to you. And beside Johnny, if you need a pencil, just say something. Just ask and I can bring you dozens of pencils from work.
My guest is Don Ariely, who is the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University, with appointments at the Fuqua School of Business, the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience, the Department of Economics, and the School of Medicine. His latest book is The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. It's published by Harper, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Dan Ariely. His latest book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, published by Harper. Can you tell us about SMORC?
Yes. So SMORC is my acronym for the simple theory of rationality and how it applies to dishonesty, which is basically a cost-benefit analysis. Now, the reality is that the only time that the SMORC applies is that we don't feel bad about our dishonesty at all. So think about something like corruption. When something is standard and everybody's doing it and everybody's accepting that they're doing it, or something when you have illegal download, then you could say the only tools you have is to basically frighten people. But the good news, you know, this is a very depressing book in some ways because it tells us all about how we lie, how the people that deal with us
lie. You all see ourselves in this book, unfortunately.
That's right. And the good news is that for most behaviors, from an economic perspective, we don't lie enough. Right. Think about your own day. From the time you're here until the time you leave to go home, you probably will have lots of opportunities to steal stuff from the station or from your coworkers where nobody would find out. But nevertheless, my guess is you're not going to take most of those opportunities. And what's holding you back is not the cost-benefit analysis. What's holding you back is your own understanding about morality. Now, what is...
I wouldn't want it done to me.
You wouldn't want it done to you. You don't want to think about yourself in this way. And that's what's holding you back. And what we need to recognize is that this power within us, right? On one hand, it's the power that we can harness to get people to behave better. It's the power we have to maintain. By the time we get to stuff that everybody accepts, that this is just the way you do business or you download illegal stuff, it's incredibly hard to keep honesty around. So we really have to think about how do we keep and maintain honesty as a social good.
Well, there are three basic elements of the SMORC view of dishonesty. Your fundamental research consisted of something you call the matrix test. What was that?
So we have a sheet of paper with 20 simple math problems, and we tell to people, why don't you solve as many of those as you can in 5 minutes? And when you finish, count how many questions you got correctly. People do it very fast. They solve as many as they can. At the end of the 5 minutes, we say, stop, count how many questions you got correctly, and now please walk to the back of the room and shred the piece of paper. People do it. They shred the piece of paper. And now we say, and come back to the front of the room and tell us how many questions you got correctly. People come. They report 6 questions on average, and we give them $6, and they go home. What the people in the experiment don't know is that we played with a shredder. So the shredder only shred the sides of the page, but the main part of the page remains intact. We could go in and find out how many questions people really solve. And what we find is the average person solves 4 problems, just reporting 6. And this is kind of the fudge factor, right? It's the ability to cheat a little bit just by a couple of questions in a way that you could probably justify. You say, oh, I probably would have solved a bit more. I deserve a bit more money. Something else happened. And therefore, people cheat a little bit. And lots of people do that.
You said that at this point you wanted to get out of the lab into a more natural setting and look at people other than students. What were you hoping to see there?
So often when we do experiments in the lab, there's a kind of questions about how students behave compared to what some people call regular people, even though I think students are regular people. So we always try to start with students, which are easy for us, and then try to expand to other people. So we wanted to create more natural environments and experiment with things that happen more in the daily life. So we tried all that. We've also tried to go to other countries and see how people behave in other countries as well.
Is it pretty consistent?
So yeah. So in our experiments, I grew up in Israel. And the first place I went to was to try how Israelis cheat. So before reading the book, what would you have predicted? Israelis cheat more or less than Americans?
I'm not going to say.
Okay. I predicted they would cheat more, but in fact they cheated less. Then Francesca Gino, my collaborator in Italy, said, you know, come to Italy. She said, we'll show you what Italians can do. But Italians cheat just like the Americans. We tried China, we tried Turkey, we tried Canada. So far, England, so far everybody cheats the same way. But here is how I understand it right now. I think that we all have the same basic capacity to rationalize our actions very quickly. And that's kind of 15% fudge factor that we're able to. But it doesn't mean that society doesn't, and that social structure doesn't matter. If we dealt with a task that was embedded in social construct, for example, infidelity or paying taxes or what you could do with insurance companies or bribing, all of a sudden the societal structure would change our tolerance for that particular domain. So I think that people have a generalized a level of dishonesty across domain, but then in each particular domain, society comes and say, in this domain, we can tolerate more dishonesty. In this domain, we can tolerate less, and so on.
Can you also affect that by planting certain ideas in people's head? For example, before you do a test, talk about the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, so we asked people before they came to do this matrix test, we asked them to try and recall the Ten Commandments. By the way, we asked hundreds of people and nobody could recall all Ten Commandments. And
even religious people?
Even religious people. Well, you know, we had a sample from UCLA, so you could decide for yourself what this is. So nobody could remember the Ten Commandments. They invented all kinds of interesting commandments, by the way, which was very amusing to see what people think should be in the Ten Commandments. But then they didn't cheat at all. And it wasn't as if the more religious people, the people who remembered a few more commandments cheated less, and the people who couldn't remember almost any of them cheated more. The moment we got people to acknowledge and think about morality, basically our own tolerance, as if we became more vigilant about our own morality, and people were much more careful.
Well, a caller wanted to know about the role that religion plays. Are religious people more likely to be honest?
So I don't think we can say that in a very general way.
Because we do hear about members of pretty much every religious group stepping over the line.
That's right. And I think that religious people have very strict rules for some behaviors. And I think strict rules are incredibly important. So I think strict rules are going to help people behave in very specific ways in a much better way. But what the religion is going to be generalized and also apply to the aspects of life that are not about religion, that one I'm not so sure about. It's kind of on our list of things to do, but I'm not sure this is the case.
Although you did say that religious symbols have an impact.
That's right. So you, when we get people to recite the Ten Commandments, or if you have a sign of religion just next to you, it will have an effect. We also find that the Catholic confession works quite well. So in the experiment I described to you earlier, we get people to cheat a little bit, and they start cheating a lot. And then when we give them a chance for confession, to say, here is what I've done bad, and here is how much I am sorry, all of that basically decrease their ability to cheat, and after confession, people start a new page. Which, by the way, I think we should apply this to also politics and to Wall Street. Allow people to have the opportunity to open a new page and restart things fresh.
Well, in ancient societies, debtors suddenly were forgiven their debts by the decree of the king, and I can't imagine that happening anymore. My guest is Dan Ariely. His latest book is The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. It's published by Harper. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What about honor codes? For example, at Princeton, there's been an honor code in effect since 1893. Do people adhere to it?
Only when they sign the honor code. So we did the same experiment I described earlier, and some people we got to sign the honor code. I understand that this experiment falls under the honor code. And we started doing this experiment at Yale and MIT, and it turns out it worked like magic. People sign the honor code, absolutely no cheating. They don't sign the honor code, we see this 15-20% cheating. And what's interesting about MIT and Yale is they don't have an honor code. So people sign something that means nothing, but nevertheless they didn't cheat at all. When we do the same thing at Princeton, we find that when people sign the honor code, they don't cheat at all. And when they don't sign it, they cheat just like the MIT and Yale students. Now, you know, it's not a randomized experiment. We don't assign randomly people to go to MIT and Yale or to Princeton. But if you think about those as similar people, it suggests that the honor code, even 2 weeks after this intensive lecture series that the Princeton students get about morality, that it doesn't carry. So the good news is that if you get people to reflect on their own morality, even if it has no ramification, gets people to behave well. The bad news is that crash course on morality don't seem to to work. This also gets us back to the discussion on religion. I think if you think about what religion does, is I think as long as it creates very strict rules for particular behaviors, it's going to regulate how people behave in that particular sense. But if you ask whether it's going to create a generalized lessons to how to deal with life, that I haven't seen evidence for so far.
Have you done any studies into the concept of a just society?
Yes. Mike Norton and I have been very interested in the question of what's a just society. And economists have all kinds of ways to define just society, how much unemployment you want, how much inequality. We decided to take a different step. We went to the definition of the famous philosopher John Rawls. And John Rawls had this beautiful definition, saying that a just society is a society that if you knew everything about it, you would be willing to enter it in a random place. And if you think about it, it's a really beautiful definition. If you're wealthy, your conflicts of interest are going to bias you to want a society where the wealthy have a lot of money and the poor don't. If you're poor, your conflicts of interest would influence you to believe you want a society that the poor have more money, the wealthy have less. But if you don't know where you'll end up, you have to consider all the possibilities and you have to be more general about it. So we asked about 20,000 Americans to describe to us what kind of wealth distribution they would want. And there were a couple of really interesting things. First of all, people don't understand how unequal the distribution of wealth in society is. People think that the bottom 40% of Americans own 10% of the wealth. They own 0.3% of the wealth. People understand a little bit how much the rich have. They particularly don't understand how much the poor have. But then we ask people to create a society that they would like to enter. And people create a society in terms of wealth distribution that was much more equal than Sweden. In fact, when we gave people a distribution of wealth that is more equal than Sweden, and a distribution of wealth that is more equal, that is based on the U.S., and we asked which one would you like to live under the veil of ignorance, 92% of Americans picked the Swedish distribution.
You think even people who are members of the Tea Party?
Yes. So we broke it. We had 20,000 people, and we broke it by wealth and gender and so on. So there were slight differences. For example, in this question of which of these two societies you would live, I told you the average is 92. For Republicans, it was 90.5%. For Democrats, it was 93%. So it was different, right? People who are more Republicans want a more unequal society, but it wasn't such a big difference. And actually, it made me think that the Rawls constraint is really a really interesting idea. You know, I'll give you the analogy. Whenever you drink wine, you're going to influence by the label and the price. But if you do blind tasting, you really have to confront your own senses. And I think similar, when we come to society, we have a very hard time to strip our own current state. What is my current wealth? What do I currently believe? What's good for me personally from a conflicts of interest perspective? But the Rawls definition of saying, imagine you can enter society in a random place, also is like a blind taste. And all of a sudden you have to think of truly what's a just society. And what I find kind of comforting is that Republicans and Democrats are really quite close in that regard. We did this study, by the way, also on listeners of NPRs and readers of Forbes magazine. Absolutely no difference. We did it on people who go to Harvard to different departments, business school, sociology. You know, the business school student wanted to give the poor slightly less money, but in general, they were much, much more equal. And I find that optimistic because I think that as long as we can have a real discussion about what our values are, I think Americans are much more similar than a political system would lead one to believe.
Mitt Romney says that corporations are people. Are corporations honest in the same way or dishonest in the same way that the rest of us are?
So I think corporations are very, very tricky. And I think there's a tremendous issue about what corporations are. So we have this ideology about shareholder value. And we did a study in which we told people, imagine you're the CEO of this bank and this bank has lost some money recently because of all kinds of regulations. And there's all kinds of things you could do which the industry called revenue enhancement. You can change the ATM fees, you can hold checks for a little longer, you can delay things, you can increase penalties and so on. And we said, which one of those 15 activities would you engage in and which not? And to some people, we told them that their motto of their bank is maximizing shareholder value. And to other people, we did not tell them that this is the motto of the bank. And what we found is that the moment shareholder value was held as an ideology, all of a sudden people could engage in much worse behavior. And going back to cheating, I think what happened, if you're a CEO and you have a conflict of interest to want to give yourself a higher salary through shares, the moment you're doing it selfishly, it's just for you, you would feel bad about it. But if you can tie it to an ideology that says, this is shareholder value, I'm not doing it for myself. In fact, I'm doing something that is good for everybody else. I'm just doing my duty. All of a sudden, you can be selfish, but justifying by a bigger frame, which I think has been a tremendous travesty for companies in the U.S.
Well, rationalization seems to be behind so many of these things. Something I've witnessed that you write about, annoying waiters can affect a person's honesty.
Yeah. So in this experiment, we got a waiter to come to people and say, hey, would you mind filling this survey for 5 minutes for $5? And people mostly say yes. And he gave them the survey. And when they finished, he gave them the money. He said, here's your $5. Please count it and sign the receipt. But he actually gave them $9. So they got extra money. And now the question is, will they tell him? And about 50% of the people say and 50% don't say. But in another condition, he annoyed people. He annoyed them very little. As he was explaining the task, he basically picked up his cell phone as if somebody was calling him. And he had a 12-second call with John about pizza tonight. Said, bye. See you later. What happened now? Very, very few people, much, much fewer. Basically, 15 to 20% of the people now return the money. Now, what happens here is the moment you're annoyed, you can justify things for yourself.
A smaller tip for the cab driver who went the wrong way, for example.
Yeah, anything like that. And it's basically our selfishness gets to exhibit itself in a higher level. Now, in that experiment, we did one more thing. Sometimes the waiter said it's his money, it's the waiter's money. So if you punished him, if you took the $9, you would punish the person who offended you. And sometimes he said it's a money of this professor, I just work for them. So under those conditions, people would not punish the perpetrator, they would not punish the waiter, they would punish somebody else who was uninvolved in the whole thing. It didn't really matter. The moment people were annoyed, they were able to justify misbehavior no matter who was going to suffer because of that.
You were lied to repeatedly during your recovery from an accident that left you with real problems. Were you angered when you discovered that you were lied to?
So at the moment, yes. I'll tell you the kind of two stories. One is that there were some treatments. There are many things. So as you know very well, I was badly burned and I was in hospital for 3 years and
we've talked about it in previous shows.
Yeah, and I think one thing is they hid for me for a long time how I looked and what are the long-term consequences of burns. You know, everybody gets burns at some point, and it usually goes away. And it's really hard to understand what extensive burn, what 70% of your body being burned means. It's a very, very different story than just having a small burn. And they didn't tell me how my life would look like, which I think kept me much more sane in the beginning and much more depressed when I realized what it really meant. There are also cases in which I had tremendously painful treatments that they were just not preparing me for, which I think was good because the pain was unavoidable, but I did not have the agony. But I think the thing that got me thinking about conflicts of interest more clearly was the story about fixing myself.
Fixing yourself in what way?
So half of my face is burned and half of my face is not burned.
It's not apparent now.
Oh, thank you. When I a little bit more in different light, it shows more, and it also has been many years, so it's getting lower. So at some point I go to the burn department, and the head of the burn department says, Dan, I have the ideal treatment for you. Come with me to my office. I go with him to my office, and he says that he wants to tattoo the right side of my face. The left side of my face has hair. The right side has nothing. He said he would make little black dots. Well, here's the story. It turns out it wasn't really a good treatment for me, but he wanted to do it just to get the paper published.
Dan Ariely's book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, is published by Harper. Thank you so much for being with us again, and I'm glad you didn't get the tattoo.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.